I get a little bit more tolerance. Will the COFDM have a similar situation where later versions of the demodulator equalizer will possibly be more tolerant of a multipath? Over to you, Eric.
Well, as with anything, you know, time doesn't heal all, but things usually get better over time. Don't forget, they've been doing COFDM in Europe now for quite a few years. So that technology has moved ahead. The difference between ACSB and COFDM is quite significant in terms of how data is transmitted. It's not, you don't look at it the same way as you would ACSB, where up and down in frequency there's data, so to speak. And you have the ability to determine amplitude and phase of each one of these little bits that are make up the COFDM transmission, and you can measure those particular parameters and utilize that to interpolate stuff. Think of when you do a transmission hologram, when you cut it up into little bits, you still have all the information, but not that much resolution. You know, you have less resolution with each one that you cut. It's not exactly the same principle, but it's just sort of the same idea to give you a little picture of it.
Would I be correct in assuming, Eric, that the broadcast centers that we have in the major metropolitan areas in the United States is a little bit different than Europe? Europe, their television broadcast over the air is a little bit more distributed, not quite cell sites, but as such, isn't a typical viewer in Europe possibly within range of more than one place the signal is being emitted from, and yet the system is, with COFDM, rather tolerant of that situation? If what I just said is true, and COFDM, I believe, existed at the time that we made the decision for 8VSB. I'm a little bit curious as to why we did not give more consideration to all of the previous history that had already gone down in Europe on COFDM. What made us reject COFDM? I know there may not be a simple answer to this one. It may be more politics. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, now let me give you a quick little story here. Cap Cities, Capital Cities, is it? Oh no, Sinclair, sorry, wrong broadcaster. Sinclair Broadcasting is the COFDM maven of the United States. They brought suit to the FCC, actually, at the time that the decision was being made as to which format to use. And Sinclair was the big horn for going COFDM, and that's what they really wanted, which they finally got with ATSC3, which made them very happy. But the administration of that day made the final decision, and there's politics involved, put it that way.
Yeah, in the big picture, it's a little bit sad that Europe was on COFDM and put a lot of technology into it, a lot of deployed hardware,
and more money for electricity.
But a lot of hardware deployed, a lot of history developed, a lot of development had taken place, a lot of the bugs were gone. COFDM was pretty well established, and yet we decided, well, we can do it better, we're going to do 8VSB. And
HVSB and COFDM pretty much occurred concurrently.
Okay. So you're telling me, I thought COFDM had some history already in Europe when we were making the HVSB decision.
They were in the same boat, so to speak. The timing is very close to one another, but actually COFDM really came out of the satellite world.
Okay. Are you telling me that my satellite downlinks right now? Okay.
Satellite downlink is either VPSK, QPSK, APSK, or 256 QAM.
Okay. Back in the days when it was roughly 30 megs wide per transponder, FM modulated, quasi-analog, are you telling me satellite analog downlink is almost unused these days?
Oh, hell no, but it's packed to the brim. But there ain't no analog on it.
Okay, so the basic format of the transmission from the satellite, as far as the transponder is concerned, he's a bent pipe reproducing an FM modulated signal. But the format of the signal itself is essentially digital, no longer analog. Is that true?
No, that's not true. You're thinking that the satellite modulated this stuff. The satellite's linear transponder. What you stick in is what comes out.
Agreed. But what the bent pipe is reproducing is the format of that FM modulated signal, analog or digital as far as the information content is.
Why do you call it FM?
The frequency is sweeping up and down as it goes through that traveling wave tube of that bent pipe transponder. Go ahead.
All right, okay, if you want to think of it that way. I don't think of digital transmission as FM. But yeah, okay, it's phase modulation. That's FM, all right. I'll live in your world for a little while. Yeah, I mean, I could be transmitting 500 kilohertz worth of bandwidth, you know. I don't need the full 27 megahertz of a transponder. I can pack 100 channels into one transponder.
Power on a geosynchronous satellite is at a huge premium. The majority of the RF circuitry, I believe, is running Class C. You get very high efficiency out of Class C. That's the good news. Class C loves phase, it loves angular modulation. You put 16 QAM through a traveling wave tube on a synchronous satellite, I think you're going to get a fair amount of distortion. I don't think you can tolerate it. I think the primary transmission through that bent pipe transponder is angular modulation. That's my belief, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, it is. You know, VPSK is just two different frequencies. QPSK is four phases on one frequency. And on, it's just, yeah, there's some issues there in terms of linear distortion and group delay even.
Okay, BPSK and quadraphase shift keying or whatever, these have a digital sound to them, but it is a pure angular modulation that can be passed through a Class C amplifier, without the amplifier creating any additional distortion, as long as it doesn't have a group delay. As long as the group delay distortion is properly handled, then it is an angular modulation Class C amplifier as I see it. Now, the formatting of the signal itself can have digital characteristics, but the real RF going through that transponder, I think, is almost purely angular modulation only, and there isn't more than one frequency simultaneously going through a transponder where the two signals can be beating against each other and giving you a time domain amplitude modulation, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Eric. K2RIW. Those are my beliefs.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, let me give you this example. Take a news organization like NBC, and they've got, you know, a couple of transponders which they own, and they will simultaneously from 10 or 12 or 14 different locations go on the air, all pointed at that same transponder, each sitting one next to each other. Literally, you've got a bit of real estate, and you can put, and they put literally multiple carriers into that real estate, of course, not one on top of each other, not any two on the same frequency. And they'll occupy a certain bandwidth of that transponder, and the transponder will sound very well.
Okay, is there more than one RF signal going through a single transponder's traveling wave tube, so to speak. Is there more than one RF signal going through a single traveling wave tube? And if so, how many megacycles is the separation of those two signals? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, the question of Nyquist stilted, if you looked at it on a spectrum analyzer, it'll look like what you see with HDSB or QAM, or even COFDM. There's actually little guide bands that they use, because they use, I think they use, depending upon which modes, after the Sprint bought all this stuff. I think some of them are as narrow as like 3/4 of a megahertz wide, which is enough to produce a really nice quality picture.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm getting a yes or a no here. Are there multiple RF carriers?
Yes, coming from different places on the Earth, but all at the same time, going to the same transponder, but not on the same frequency.
Exactly. What's the closest frequency separation between multiple frequencies going through one particular transponder?
It's a very small number. There is actually a real number because they've canalized how they break it down. But don't forget, these skirts on these signals are very, very sharp, so they don't overlap very much. You know, they don't flare out in frequency very much. They're pretty much a straight line. They're not a straight line, you know. When you get down about 50 dB, they start to get a little wider, so you're going to see some stuff. But it's a very small space between them. That's the reason why in even ABSD we can have a station between 50 and 54, and the next station starts right there.
You can get away with that because of good modern-day brick wall filtering, is what I call it. In other words, a filter that's got extremely smooth, flat top, extremely steep skirts, and very well-controlled group delay distortion. Alrighty. You believe that multiple signals on slightly different frequencies. In the old days, some of the transponders were 90 megahertz, 70 megahertz or 90 megahertz wide. Are the individual transponders still that wide these days, Eric? Go ahead.
Depends on the satellite. Still normal 27 megahertz or 30 megahertz. There's some that are 150. Actually, I'm going to bring up a typical satellite, and I'll tell you exactly what's on one transponder. And in many cases, what they'll do is, like the cable service, which has a series of transponders, they will actually use one exciter that takes up the whole 27 megahertz available to it and pack each one of their programs and streams. There are some providers that share transponders. They'll take 2 megahertz of this transponder and emanate from their downlink facility, and they'll take another 3 megahertz from that same transponder, and it'll be coming from a different uplink facility somewhere. So, yeah. But the one thing that we got to remember with this digital stuff is that there is a certain amount of understood distortion that has to, or pre-distortion, if you want to call it, that has to take place at the transmitter. So, it takes into consideration the characteristic of the satellite itself. K2RIW, K2J.
You can put a rather large number of signals simultaneously through a traveling wave tube-like amplifier. Large number of signals.
By the way, most modern-day satellites aren't tubes anymore.
Back in the old days when they were traveling wave tubes, you could put multiple signals through them with great linearity between all of those signals if you used a significant amount of backoff. Backoff really means the transmitter has got 30 watts of peak envelope power capability, but you're only using 10 watts of it.
You still do that.
So they're using backoff in order to be able to transmit multiple signals without them beating against each other and making amplitude to phase distortion. Linear Technology is one of the companies that builds devices that will allow you to use less backoff and still get the right amount of intermodulation distortion. So I think you're saying that They are using backup. If your ground station dish is big enough, you don't need full power output of the satellite. You can back it off and therefore get the linearity you need and put multiple signals through it. Is that sort of what's going on in some cases, Eric? K2LAW?
Even back in the old analog days, the first thing you do when you're going to light up a bird is that you would call up that particular bird's control center. And they will walk you through powering up into their bird. And they'll tell you exactly how much power to put and tell you when you're using too much and to back it off. And they'll also double check your frequency and make sure that, because what you do is you light up with a CW carrier first, and they check that out, and then you start to occupy your bandwidth. So those rules still hold today. So there's always somebody watching what's going into a transponder. It's not, you know, you just point the dish up and that's the end of it.
And the major disadvantage of me giving too much uplink power, where they don't have to plug in some decibels on the input front end of the satellite, if I use too much input power, I probably could put the, if in the gauge of the traveling wave tube, you can get what's called fallback power. In other words, you overdrive the tube and the power output doesn't increase, it decreases. I'm guessing solid state doesn't have as much of that fallback.
Oh, it just saturates.
Okay.
You wind up getting all sorts of IM products when that happens.
There's my next question. Even with a modern day solid state satellite that doesn't have fallback, I still can overdrive the front end, and that creates intermodulation distortion products?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of safety built into this stuff. They, you know, satellite technology's gone leap years away from where it was 10 years ago, even. You know, all the inputs have attenuators and remotely controlled stuff so that the control center can deal with it. As far as with automatic fallback within the bird, I couldn't give you the answer to that. I actually don't know.
Yeah, every traveling wave tube has got fallback if you overdrive it. Now, because the uplink frequency and the downlink frequency in the old days used to be different on these satellites, I presume it still is, there is a mixing and translation action going on, and you don't want to overdrive that mixer. Over to you, Eric.
No, that's true in any kind of linear amplifier, period. You know, the front end can only deal with so much energy, and that's it. One of the things that I forgot to mention is that when we were talking about what Paul was talking about, you know, a direct-to-home satellite being 150 or 200 watts, the commercial satellites that the broadcasters and the cable folks use are still only, you know, 15 or 25 watts. There's no major power amplifiers and everything. You still need a fairly decent-sized dish to have, you know, good results. You look at my backyard, that dish isn't very small. And that dish happens to be looking at a bird that's hanging over where Alaska is. So, it's, you know, it's real low on the horizon. K2IW, K2J.
People who are using a satellite receiving system, 18-inch diameter dish, aren't they looking at a satellite that's transmitting over 100 watts, Eric?
Yes, they are. And they're looking at very specific use satellites. It's actually not KU, it's really kind of K. It's a little lower than our traditional KU because it was set up for the home, you know, the direct-to-home satellites. Those are generally 150, they're actually making them now 250 watts, so. You get a lot of signals out of that little dish on your house, and it's only a really bad, rainy, stormy day that it becomes painful.
And the laws of physics that make that rainy day give you troubles is not insertion loss. It's cross-polarization characteristics. Clockwise and counterclockwise, or horizontal and vertical, get mixed. And the adjacent channels that overlap each other, even the adjacent transponders that are 50% frequency overlaps, they start getting mixed, and the converter down on the ground says, I can't figure out what the hell's going on here. In the early days of those direct TV, direct KU band, they were called, satellites, 150 watts, they were super high-power traveling wave tubes. The 150 and 250-watt satellites today, have they all become solid-state to your knowledge, Eric, K2RIW?
Yeah, as far as I know, in like the last 10 years, they stopped putting 2WPs. You don't need the power supplies. You don't need all that extra weight and everything. You know, we got transistors that operate in hundreds of watts at those frequencies nowadays. So it's, you know, it's just give it the power you need for the output that you want to make the solar arrays bigger.
Yeah, there are solid-state devices that will give you that kind of power at those frequencies. But each individual stage has a hell of a lot less gain than a traveling wave tube. So your driver chain is a lot more elaborate. So you've got a whole lot of cascaded amplifier stages to properly drive that final stage. As such, you've got a lot of individual circuits to worry about linearity and intermodulation distortion and the group delay and whatever. So that's a fairly elaborate design. And a good traveling wave tube can easily give you 35, 45 dB of gain. A milliwatt of drive will give you hundreds of watts of output. And at times, that's awful handy. And they have, with some difficulty, managed to make some very highly reliable traveling wave tubes, obvious by what they're using on Voyager, 37 years downrange, and we're still listening to that particular traveling wave tube. So with all those cascaded stages required for solid-state drive, I'm amazed that they were able to solve that problem. So you believe all the last, what, 5 or 10 years' worth of satellites are essentially all solid-state at KU band, 150, 250-watt level, KE2VJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2VJ. As I said before, it's really only the direct-to-home satellites that have those kinds of power levels. So, you know, they used to put sometimes 4 extra transponders in there just because sometimes the tube wouldn't even make it up the ride.
Okay, so your satellites that you're using, I can easily see them as solid state. Are these direct-to-home satellites, do you think they're solid state? 150 and 250-watt level at that frequency range for those bandwidths, that's a very difficult design. Are you sure that those are solid state, Eric?
I'll tell you what. I'll find out for sure, and I'll let you know. I mean, it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I was part of a design team way back in 2000 that for a particular military project, we needed, I'm going to round off the numbers, we needed 10 to 20 gigahertz instantaneous bandwidth at the hundreds of watts level, and we wanted it to be solid state. In the year 2000, that was way out of the question. That had to be a tube. And I know the world has come along quite a bit since then. In the last 17 years, I'm sure a lot of progress has been made. But that kind of instantaneous bandwidth at that kind of power level in 2000 was out of the question. Over to you for any comments on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Sorry, that's for the satellite specs. I wasn't paying attention to you. Say it again for me.
Hey, Dick, can I ask you a question?
You can ask me a question, Joe.
Could you change your power level so you're not hitting so many receivers? Because I don't know if you're running duplex, but I can hear a continuous clicking every 4, 5, 6 seconds, like a switch on receivers. And maybe if you decrease the power level, that might help make that not happen too much.
You're hearing the same clicking noise when Eric is transmitting. Over to you, Joe.
No, I'm not.
I am. I'm waiting to hear the clicking right now. All of a sudden, I'm not hearing. You want my power to be increased or decreased? Which are you asking for, Joe?
Try decreasing it.
Okay. If I decrease my power... Okay, I see what you're saying. You're saying the voting system is what's creating the clicking. I'm hearing clicking. I've just decreased my power. I'm at the threshold where I'm hearing some hiss in the background. And I'm hearing clicking. So the voting is still going on as I see it, or is there some other source of impulse noise going through the system?
Give me a second, I'll tell you what the repeater's doing.
Roger, Dodger. I'll give you a continuous carrier while you're doing that test.
My computer's got a boot, it's gonna take a minute.
Roger, Dodger. Let's see, that was Joe's question. You believe the clicking is coming from the continuous changing of the voting system? Is that what you believe is going on, Joe?
Yeah, like the voter's going someplace it shouldn't be.
Well, Eric will eventually be finding that out. So, our television system is about to go through another revolution. another evolution. Will it ever settle down? We're squeezing more and more channels in less and less space, changing the overall format, protocol, but we've come a long way. The 4K sets sure look attractive. We're getting darn close to the resolution on that screen these days, as you used to get out of a very good 35mm slide in Kodachrome 2. I mean, at one time, that was the standard of high-resolution video display, high-resolution illumination. What's the word I'm looking for? You know what I mean. So, when Eric comes back, I'm going to be asking, has anyone even proposed anything beyond 4K? I think there's not much need for it. But for that matter, the first time we had 1K or 2K, we didn't think there was any more need. Over to you, Eric.
I think it's time to realign the voter. I'm on Plainview. Before I was on Glen Oaks. Yeah, I was hopping around while you were talking. Looks like I'm going to have to find some time and go up there and do a full alignment. The NHK has something called super high vision, which is 8K, and the pictures are unbelievable.
Okay. Already 12 million people have bought a 4K TV set. And when you're going to numbers like 60 inches on that screen, you really need 4K. So you're saying 8K is about to come around the corner. Wow. The actual display itself, these are individual light-emitting diodes, Eric, go ahead.
What I saw was actually projection. They have the OLED screens for that. It's just, you know, the same process, just multiplying by 4.
In order to have 8K resolution, what's the approximate number of individual light-emitting diodes that are on that display device?
Whatever the power of 2 that comes up to 896, is it? I don't remember. I can't calculate that in my head. I think it's 4,000 lines? No, 8,000 lines. It's 892. I can take a calculator and calculate it out. Something like 30 or 20,000 pixels across on a line. Is it 20,000? Depends on the HDR. Anyway, it's one heck of a lot of pixels. If you consider that the normal HD 1080, you multiply 1920 by 1080, you get the number of pixels you need, then multiply by 3 for the green and blue.
Are we talking about numbers like 50 megapixels on that screen?
Something ridiculous like that.
How in the world do they address that many pixels? How many wires there must be at the edge of that screen feeding those command signals to those light-emitting diodes?
Well, if you've ever seen the way the screens are manufactured and how the lenses are matrixed out, essentially you make an 8K picture by taking, you take four of 2K screens and put them together in a quad.
But you're addressing those individual pixels by wiring coming off the perimeter of that screen. That is one hell of a ribbon cable that's feeding that. And if one of those lines of that ribbon cable fails, then you get a whole horizontal streak across that screen of dead pixels. And yet, I hear very few people complaining about streaks of dead pixels on screens.
No, usually you'll find a dead pixel.
Okay. How is that individual pixel being addressed? Isn't there some horizontal wiring and vertical wiring that has to come together to address that particular pixel?
I don't know if you've ever opened up the back of your TV set, but there's probably three small boards there. The LFIs that they make. Actually, the edge of the multiplexer on the edge of the screen itself has a... it's got a multiplexer chip glued to it, so you're not getting thousands of wires. But it is row, it's row and column. And brightness is controlled by PWM, pulse width modulation.
Pulse width modulation, red, blue, and green, lots and lots of pixels. Wow. All right, so the multiplexing is taking place on the screen itself, but still somewhere after that multiplexing chip, there's still got to be thousands of horizontal wires and thousands of vertical wires to be able to address those individual chips. So somewhere in that screen, there's a hell of a lot of perimeter wires. Is that
printed?
What was that again, Eric?
Printed.
I'm amazed at getting the reliability out of that. OLED, which stands for
organic.
Organic light emitting diode. What does the word organic really mean? I'm having trouble believing that those individual light emitting diodes are made out of living material. Over to you, Eric.
Think organic chemistry, okay? How do you make an LED that makes a color?
Please tell me.
Well, this is sort of like making a picture tube in a certain sense. Instead of electrons, you're using photons. The energy from ultraviolet. You essentially have ultraviolet LEDs with a little phosphor in front of it. The composition of the phosphor is made from, I don't remember exactly specifically what the organic materials are, but they're in there.
There are a very small number of light-emitting diode designs that will directly emit a red signal, an infrared signal, an ultraviolet signal, and so on. Green is done by a frequency doubling crystal, which is really running infrared into a crystal. So I think you're saying nowhere near are we available light-emitting diodes that are directly red, green, and blue. So it's really an ultraviolet light-emitting diode hitting a red or green phosphor inside of the LED.
So the point of the matter is that you can make the phosphor have a very specific wave shape, and be at a very specific frequency. So when you're making a display, it has a specific color temperature.
So the phosphor itself, is that what is the organic, the phosphor, not the light-emitting diode, which is probably silicon?
I think I'm going to double-check my thoughts before I give them, because I'm not quite sure.
The day will come when you can buy a light-emitting diode that directly puts out the wavelength you want. I think we're not there yet. They're still developing those. So I think the real color is coming from fancy chemistry of the phosphor being lit up by the light-emitting diode in ultraviolet, probably ultraviolet, and then it is fluorescing in the color that we desire. That's my guess as to what might be going on. Oh, you are.
WS2N question on the LEDs.
Okay, I just looked it up. I'm right. Okay, the LED is an emissive electroluminescent layer of thin organic compound that emits light in response to the excitation.
And are some sets using red, green, and blue, and also yellow is thrown in there? And by the way, there are a small number of human beings who have cones in their fovea or macula of their eye, which are red, green, and blue, plus yellow. Over you, Eric. Don't they sometimes have to throw in a fourth color in order to get good flesh tone reproduction? KE2EJ, KE2IW.
No, it's actually Sharp that came up with that idea. You're talking about the transmission of light as opposed to reflection of light. When we look at, you know, a picture, a painting, you're looking at whatever the room lighting source, or if you're outside, whatever the color temperature and the composition of that light is what your eyeballs see reflected off that by those wavelengths being absorbed by the picture, as opposed to the transmission principle where we're actually generating the light. So the concept of adding yellow in there reduces the amount of literally matrixing that you have to do, because you now have another point in which to add that information, and you wind up having more dynamic range or more limited drop. You have more control in terms of from the original picture, which you're matrixing out what is supposed to be yellow, which is subjective by the camera operator, because the camera doesn't have a yellow tube in it. The camera has, a yellow sensor. It's got a red, green, and blue sensor. And from that, we matrix out what we call luminance, or green. We still use that even in the digital realm of the world. And then we matrix out the red and the blue component minus the green component, or minus luminance, and we're able to reduce the amount of bandwidth that takes. So some of the leftovers from good old NTSC is still with us.
To my knowledge, most human eyes have red, green, and blue cones in the macular, high-resolution section of the center of the eye, red, green, and blue cones. Therefore, when you and I see what we call yellow, the brain has seen a certain level of green, and the brain says, hey, I got half red, half green amplitude, I'm going to interpret that as yellow. Here's my real question. What percentage of the high end television set displays have more than red, green, and blue? Do some of them have a fourth color built into the display to better get the less matrixing grief and better flesh tones, for instance? Are there high-end sets out there with more than three colors being emitted by the individual pixels? Over to you, Eric. K2RIW.
K2RIW, K3J. The short and long answer to that question is yes. And the company that manufactures it is Sharp, and they hold the patent rights or copyright to putting those out, because they were the first ones to do that. And the fact that it appears as though you have better flesh tone, the reason for that is that the phosphors have a certain amount of bandwidth in terms of where they live and lighting output. And the spaces of frequency between the red and the green, and the green and the blue, they overlap, but they overlap at the bottoms of their skirts rather than up towards the middle. So when you now add another source of light that color temperatures in between the red and the green, you now get more dynamic range. You're now able to resolve more accurately the different level of brightness of that particular color. So it's really a physics point of view, not your eyeball in being able to perceive it. It's really the concept of being able to generate that light in the first place.
The color pink, does that have a specific color temperature, or is that sort of a human perception of the right mixtures of the primaries? Is pink a real wavelength? Over to you, Eric.
I don't think of the eyeball as a two-dimensional thing. It's really a three-dimensional thing. We have frequency, which we kind of call color, but we also have amplitude. Okay? And we also have what's next door in terms of brightness level. Okay, because when you have something that is brighter than something else, because of the difference in contrast, you have a tendency not to see it brighter than something else. So, pink really is red, but it has a lot of green and blue in it. So that's why it seems light. The frequency of it is still the same as the red, except that now at the same time, we're also slamming our sensors with the green light and blue light, and that's why we see it as pink.
If we're not colorblind. Paul, I know you had some questions on this. WS2N, K2RW, fire away.
Yeah, I'm wondering, with the TV screens, has things changed? I'm going back many, many years, but the red was reversed polarity, and green was straight polarity, and then you had the yellow, and the amber was AC. I mean, has that all changed within the TV screen? Is everything just straight polarity, and they're changing everything with the coatings of the, like Eric was saying, the different coatings? Back to you, Dave.
The chrominant signal was a phase amplitude modulated thing, 3.579 megahertz.
Double sideband.
That was what, double sideband, yes. So, in other words, there was an I and a Q, so to speak, with a double sideband that gave you a resultant chrominance phase and amplitude that represented the chrominant signal. That's my understanding. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, you actually had two components. One is called R minus Y, or R minus luminance. So you would subtract the green and the blue, and you would wind up with red. Have a specific set of values. There were actually a set of values that were worked out that coincides with the eyeball. There's a 52% green, 27% red, and 11% blue. And that's the basic matrix form that we broke it down. So you took the R minus Y, or the red minus the luminance signal, you put that into a balanced modulator, and you fed that with 358. Then you took the blue minus Y component, or the blue minus luminous component, and fed that into another balanced modulator. You fed that with the same 358, but 90 degrees out of phase. And the output of that is the chrominance.
In the old days, the red phosphor was very low in efficiency, and getting enough red was very difficult. I am guessing that matrix you're discussing and those values had to be steered because of that deficiency of red then. Have those values changed since, because red is now a lot easier to generate? Over to you, Eric.
Well, that kind of depends upon what your system you're talking about. Whereas when we do computer graphics, we don't do any matrixing at all. It's, you know, it's 8 bits of red, 8 bits of green, 8 bits of blue, or 16 bits, depending upon what kind of a system you're doing with the resolution. There's even systems out there that are 24 bits deep. The HDR 4K is actually 24 bits deep. That's a lot of variations in brightness. But those actual values came up in terms of how do I fit this stuff in the bandwidth that I got available. And they used the eyeball as the model, not the flashes of the set. You remember if you lit up a 21AX P22 and you went to do the purity on it, and you looked at the red, it looked orange-ish, because it really didn't produce the right output, the right frequency. But in order to get the ability to mix the colors together, it needed to be X wide, and they centered it around there. They didn't have the ability to whack those electrons into those phosphors in those days. And as time went on, plus the other thing is your eyeball looking at these dots against nothing, your eyeball tends to flatten that out too. If you had looked at it as red squares, alternating red and black squares, they'd look red rather than orange. K2RW, K2J.
There's now 12 million sets with 4K capability. Do you believe super high resolution 8K, when it comes along, do you think it's going to be almost as popular, Eric? Or is that just for the guys that like buying a Maserati, so to speak? Over to you, Eric, K2RW.
Well, Well, not everything that is invented for the home viewer. Okay. Let's look at it from this perspective. If you go into the movie theater and you're watching, well, I was going to say 35, but for the sake of it, let's say you're watching a 70mm print. It's got a certain amount of resolution, and resolution is determined by the actual particle size of the grains of silver that are on that piece of celluloid backing, right? And with a 4K set, we've now actually exceeded the resolution of that 70mm film. So that in itself is saying something, yes? And let it drop. So, when we get to 8K, all right, we developed the ability to make good 8K cameras at a reasonable cost and almost lossless compression, so we'll be able to store it. And as you know, motion pictures are now being done via electronic cinematography, which is basically a 4K camera. Lo and behold, we now start doing production with 8K cameras. And of course, you can always make a picture look great when you start from a really high resolution and bring it to a low resolution. Whereas when you go the other way, we generally wind up with garbage. And if you look at even your high def set and you look at a standard definition picture that's being line doubled, it looks kind of clunky. It's not the same world. So the practical uses of 8K beyond just having a set in the house. Let's see what happens to 4K in terms of how popular it gets. Although it seems to be catching on in the world of being able to get 4K content from either the internet or from your cable or satellite provider. K2RW, K2JAN.
I think you said that most of the movies being made these days are done with a 4K camera. Is that true, Eric? And the movie producers are starting to go over to an 8K camera?
No, I didn't say that the movie producers are going to the 8K camera. They would like to. What I did say is that the NHK is now using it. They've developed this system. Actually, they developed a 4K camera. They developed the HD camera. You know, it's something that in the near future, you'll probably be seeing 8K cameras being used for movie production instead of 4K cameras. Of course, think of it this way. When you've got that much resolution, you're capturing a picture, you basically wouldn't actually have to use different lenses. You could just use a wide lens and just zoom into the part of the picture that you're interested in rather than moving the camera. I mean, that's a silly idea, but it's something that you could actually practically do. It's something that we actually do in the video world. We have a 4K camera, we put that on the wide shot, and since we're only making 1080i, that means I can take four corners of that picture, and any of those corners is exactly the same resolution as what I would be doing my production in. So there are some big advantages to having more resolution. K2RW, K2J.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
They do that on the Mars rovers. Well, I don't know the resolution that they have, but I know it's very, very good. And, you know, they'll zoom in out. Well, they won't zoom in or out, but they'll take a picture from one location, and then because of that high pixel rate, you know, they'll change that. They'll change that scene, and you'll be able to either go in very close and look at something, you know, a rock on the ground, or look at the mountain in the distance without a zoom. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Give you a simple explanation of that.
Go ahead, Eric.
All right. Think of it this way. Think of you've got a matrix or a bunch of mailboxes. And let's just, for the sake of it, we'll say there's 4,000 rows and 4,000 columns. Right? Now I've got a display, and the display only displays 1,000 columns by 1,000 columns. So I've got this memory of mailbox, and I have to send my data to the display, so I'm going to read each mailbox and put them on the correct place on the screen. But I've only got 1,000 across and 1,000 down, so I can take 1,000 by 1,000 anywhere in that 4,000 and have a zoomed-in picture of what's in that whole 4,000.
That sounds like a kind of electronic zooming. If the modern-day television production, movie production cameras are running 4K, and maybe they're going to go to 8K, What is the medium in which that data is being stored on, Eric? Is that the equivalent of a hard drive? Over to you.
Well, in the past, it was a hard drive. Actually, it was a bunch of hard drives. Today, it's, believe it or not, some of it is SDXC memory. Some of it is what they call P2 memory. Who is it? Panavision's using SSDs. You know, there's solid-state SSDs. There's a whole number of different methods. Depends upon who you rented your cameras from. And in the movie world, they don't own them, they rent them.
Boy, a production wide-angle, you know, what do we call this now, 3D movie, they must use up gigabytes and terabytes like they're going out of style when they record that the raw data before editing. Is that true?
Usually I think they bring something like 10 terabytes for a day's worth of production. One of the things that I will say about 3D that you may not be aware of, not all, but most movies will be simulated in 3D, whereas we actually have devices in an editing system that allows you to create left eye, right eye perspectives, and you can actually edit them so that the stuff is in the right place. There are movies that are actually shot with bifocal cameras, literally camera lenses that are placed at eyeball perspective. But not all of them. The ones that will get released in 3D that are generated in the lab, so to speak, will have in the set placements that will work later on into the editing to bring out the 3D effects that they're looking for. But most movies, it's really one lens, and it's generated electronically in the end. But for those that are doing it, you figure what you're essentially doing is doubling up on the number of cameras. It depends upon whether you're shooting it as a single camera or multiple camera. Most movies are single camera, so the amount of data just isn't completely ridiculous. K2IWK, dude, yeah.
A human eye brain system sees in binaural three dimensions because of left eye, right eye, and parallax. If I'm shooting a movie with only one lens, and I'm going to later on generate the third dimension, where does the raw data come from to generate that third dimension if it wasn't done with two lenses and parallax? Over to you, Eric.
That's the beauty of mathematics. The raw data is the single lens. But when you're producing something for 3D, what you're essentially going to do now is you're going to take that single source of an image and make two images out of it. And when you make two images out of it, you're going to manipulate it.
Okay, I see two RF, huh? Okay, I think you're telling me the lens is wide enough I can use the left side and the right side of the lens and get a little bit of binaural effect. Let's see what KC2RFN's got to say. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, a friend of mine who's now deceased, named Mortimer Marks, had the patent on turning 2D images into 3D. He could take any film, any TV show, turn it into 3D. And the way he did it is that, of course, most video and film included motion picture, actually motion in front of the camera. So what he learned is that there is a differential, of course, between frame one and frame two if somebody's walking, say, across the camera. So what he would do is he would take frame one and frame two, and he would project them together and do the 3D effect that way. It was the same as having two cameras, but really using only one camera and using time as the second frame. So it would be frame one and two get projected, then two and three projected, then three and four, and it works.
Fantastic. So, you've seen some of those kind of... By the way, over the broadcast, has anyone ever proposed using very much 3D in that one, Eric?
Are you asking, has anyone ever done 3D on broadcast television?
I know they have, but how popular is it? How much of it exists today on over-the-air broadcast? On cable, I can see it, or a satellite, I can see it, but over-the-air broadcast, is there very much 3D?
Well, there's been experiments, and they were very successful. There were a couple of shows that I think NBC and ABC had done over the years that used the bicolor glasses. It's kind of really annoying. No, it's not something they do there. And by the way we do 3D is not bicolor glasses these days. Actually, most of your 4K sets and your better 1080i sets are all 3D capable.
3D movies are done nowadays with glasses that are both clockwise and counterclockwise, and I think it's circular polarization on the glasses that you wear. Is that true?
In the words of K2IW, give that man a cigar.
Yeah, when you take a pair of those glasses and hold them against each other, you know, in cascade, you get some peculiar effects. So, I think in the old days it was horizontal and vertical. Nowadays I think it's clockwise and counterclockwise. And I presume they strongly recommend you not wear those glasses out of the building and go out and drive at nighttime, because I think they could get you in trouble if you were wearing those glasses while driving at nighttime. Is that true, Eric? K2RIW?
Yeah, it is, actually. The polarization effect can affect your concept of depth. But you can actually bring those glasses home on a modern-day 3D-capable set. It'll work just fine. The clockwise and counterclockwise polarization is provided by the little filter that's in front of the screen. So it's etched into the outer layer of the display housing. The older sets, like the one I have, actually send out a little infrared signal to tell the glasses to block off the left eye and open the right eye and vice versa.
There are 12 million people out there with 4K TV sets. Make me a rough guess, Eric. How many home consumers have 3D television sets in their house? Oh, you, Eric?
There are quite a few, actually. I don't remember what the numbers are, but it flattened out after a little while because it looked at kind of as a fad. But, they don't make the wide variety that they used to make, but they still make them. You know, and the 4Ks have the filters in front of them, so it's, you'll see that some of them are, some of them aren't. They'll say 3D ready.
Some of the better consumer stores you can go to will demonstrate 3D sets. And I've tried them. I'm not super impressed. I presume the 3D capability makes a significant increase in the price of the set when you're buying it. Isn't that true, Eric?
In the beginning, yes, but not really anymore. The electronic shutter glasses was the big additional expense. But there's also a little bit of processing that goes on because you have to display both images on one screen. The newer ones do a better job of it than the older ones do. In terms of the circular polarization versus the shutter. But have you ever been to a 3D movie, and what are your opinions of that? It shouldn't be that much different than what you saw on the TV set.
Yeah, my family saw the movie Passengers in 3D recently, and it's kind of nice. We saw it in 3D because that was the only place it was showing, if you know what I mean. I had no choice. When you've got clockwise and counterclockwise built into the screen of a TV set, how does an individual pixel select clockwise and counterclockwise? Does that mean you've got double the number of pixels? You've got red, green, and blue, and you've got clockwise and counterclockwise of each? How do you do that at the micro level of the display screen, Eric? K2RIW?
K2RIWK2J. It's done by row and column. You've never seen a 3D picture transmitted. It's actually two pictures side by side. And what happens is one picture gets into rows 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, the other picture gets into rows 2, 4, 8, 10, 12, etc.
So are there vertical stripes of clockwise and vertical stripes of counterclockwise built into the display?
Yes.
So it's a little bit like the Sony Trinitron technique of...